The housing crisis on Attawapiskat and the federal response have reignited the debate over sovereignty of Canada's First Nations. The Conservative government froze the band's assets and appointed a third-party manager to oversee the band's finances. Band leaders responded by asking the manager to leave. They are now calling on the United Nations to make sure the Canadian government is meeting its obligations to First Nations people. Ottawa is demanding to know how $90 million of federal money spent on the reserve since 2006 has not provided residents with adequate housing. But critics say that money wouldn't meet the community's housing needs, even if it was all allocated for housing. The federal intervention in Attawapiskat comes just after the Conservatives introduced Bill C-27, the First Nations Financial Transparency Act. If passed, bands would have to release their financial information to members and publish them online. Supporters applaud the move for giving Aboriginals living on reserve the same rights as those living in other communities, but critics call it colonialism. While the government calls for greater accountability on First Nations, band leaders say they can't do anything without Ottawa's approval. My guest today is James Wilson, Commissioner for the Treaty Relations Commission of Manitoba. TRCM was created by a partnership between the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs and the federal government to educate the public about treaties. Hi, James.
Good morning, Cameron.
I'm hoping you can help clear up some of the muddy legal issues that surround this issue of housing on First Nations reserves and some of the broader implications that these kinds of actions have for First Nations. I'm talking about the federal intervention.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think Attawapiskat and what's happening right now with the situation there is really... To me, it's symbolic of mistrust and trouble in the relationship between First Nations and the Crown and Canada, the federal government, and that relationship that was originally established when the treaties were signed was one of a partnership where two parties come together, working together for opportunities for both sides. So the Crown wanted access, or the government wanted access to the land and its resources. First Nations leadership wanted access to opportunities, mainstream opportunities of agriculture, education, housing, etc. In exchange, they negotiated certain rights to give government access to the land. So we've gone away largely with the introduction of the Indian Act. So the treaties were signed, a mutual partnership between First Nations and the Crown, and then the Indian Act was introduced with no consultations with First Nations people. It's a very one-sided, paternalistic piece of legislation. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but some people call it just outright racist. And that's where the dysfunction in the relationship starts. So you've got places, First Nations communities that can't do anything essentially without the approval of the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada, ANSI.
So I'm glad you said that, because the way the government is talking right now, it seems as if they just handed the money, this $90 million, over to the band, and the band did whatever they want with it. But as you say, the band can't do anything without getting the permission of the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs. So how can the government be so confused?
Well, there's different levels of government involvement in a First Nations community. So there's basically at the bottom most intrusive level is third party management.
Right.
The next step up is co-management. Up from that are 1 year financial agreements. And then there's 3 year financial agreements, 5 year financial agreements, and like the least level of government interference are called self-government agreements. So there's two bands in Manitoba that are under self-government agreements. And what those are is essentially you're moving away from the Indian Act and completely becoming autonomous with how you spend your money. Now, as you go, and there's different benchmarks essentially that the government sets up mm-hmm. to move to the next level up. I don't want to really talk about the specifics of Attawapiskat, but the reporting requirements for each of the different levels are very strenuous. So you've got in excess of I can't remember the exact number, in excess of 80 financial reports that have to go to the federal government at each, depending on your financial agreement. And again, as you go higher up, it's you're more autonomous and more self-governing.
Okay. So what does it mean exactly when a government, when the government intervenes in a First Nation at any level? Like what is it saying about the First Nation and about their government?
Well, again, it's moving away from that treaty relationship, a partnership. I'll try to give both perspectives here. So you've got the First Nations perspective where First Nations are sovereign, self-governing entities. They're nations within themselves. Some would even argue nations on an equal status with Canada. So you've got that perspective. Now you've got the Crown perspective where First Nations fall under basically the hierarchy of you've got Parliament, departments, and then First Nations would be reporting to the regional directors of INAC or AANDC, a very hierarchical structure that basically would be, from some Crown perspective, equivalent to a municipality. So you've got two very different approaches and perspectives on this relationship. One is very hierarchical. The other is more, okay, we're equal. We deserve to be treated as equals and as nations, essentially. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, it does. I'm wondering if maybe we can look at the specific issue of housing and how that relationship works between the First Nations and the government, and how maybe these different perspectives on the treaty relationship can affect how they view the issue of housing.
Yeah. So again, to go back to the treaties, so there were certain rights negotiated, given to First Nations so that the Crown could access the land and its wealth in the resources. And those rights go both ways, I should say, just as a sidebar. So their treaty rights aren't something that's only shared by the only First Nations people have. Mainstream Canadians, if you own property, as an example, you're exercising a treaty right, because your right to own property is done, basically, it couldn't happen without the treaties, which goes back to the Royal Proclamation. There's a legal background to that. Now, housing is a huge issue all across First Nations communities in Canada. There's different First Nations have taken different approaches to deal with this. I shouldn't say housing is not just an issue in First Nations in Canada. Housing is an issue globally, especially when you're talking about disadvantaged people and access to wealth, access to resources, all of that. So different First Nations have taken different approaches to this because... essentially, you want everybody in your community to have access to housing. And there's also the wealth component that's built in there. You want, in the long term, you want people to have ownership of their homes and take pride in their homes and invest in their homes. I mean, investing monetary, but also physically and through sweat equity. So you have different First Nations now that are... They're using approaches to try and get as many community members as possible owning their own homes, but it's really, really difficult with the way things are set up now. Under the Indian Act, it's next to impossible to get a mortgage on reserve, because you have to, even if you have everything that would get you a mortgage off reserve, proper credit rating, income, all of that stuff, if you're on reserve, the chief and council has to co-sign your mortgage. So then that's a huge barrier. And a lot of banks just refuse to do it. So you've got essentially communities where no one can own homes, or there's very few people that own homes. So there's a bunch of First Nation communities now trying to take steps forward so that they can get as many people owning homes as their community as possible to deal with the problem, because it is a huge problem all across Canada.
There seems to be some resistance, though, from First Nations leaders and experts against this idea of band members owning their own homes because they believe in the idea of collective ownership.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a source of the problem that we're currently seeing in Aboriginal housing?
Well, there's two separate issues. One is home ownership, and the other one is land ownership. So there's legislation being introduced that's talking about land ownership. So because right now all reserve lands are owned by the Crown. So again, it goes back to that Indian Act relationship. You can't do anything without the minister approving it. So there's legislation being introduced that would allow First Nations to opt in to become the owners of their reserves. Now this is controversial because some First Nations would argue that it goes against the communal ownership of the reserve. But that's a separate issue from the home ownership. Most communities I've been in or worked with, my reserve as an example, I'm from Wapaskwet Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. We've got probably 550 or so homes on reserve, and I believe 260 or so are owned by the community members. But it's still they're on reserve land. It's owned by the federal government. It's Crown land still.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what does that mean in terms of their ability to sell their homes?
Yeah, it's difficult again because the way that our community did it, OCN, so the band started different programs through CMHC to get home ownership because to try and get around those obstacles to get a mortgage. So that has been very successful. But now, and in fact, it has created sort of a small rental market and stuff like that in the community where you've got people that bought homes and now they're renting them out and stuff like that. So, which is good. Again, we've also got a huge amount of people that need homes on the reserve. It's been successful in some cases, not so successful in other cases. Now I totally lost your question there. If you come back to,
I was just wondering how the collective ownership of the land affected the individual's ability to sell to do with their home as they want.
It's very difficult. Now, some communities have gone to certificates of possession or 99-year leases, things like that. But again, it's very hard to get a mortgage. So let's say I had a house on the reserve and I wanted to sell it. If it was someone that's not a band member, a member of the First Nations community, it would be very hard to sell it to that individual. So when you're talking about the building wealth over years, that's a huge barrier. But again, the whole move towards private property, it's viewed by some people as one step towards a solution. As other people, they view that as a kind of dangerous territory to go towards. So it is controversial. Yeah.
How do you think homeownership could help alleviate some of the housing shortages that we're seeing in communities like Attawapiskat?
Yeah, again, from my personal perspective, being from a Wapaskwet Cree Nation, the home ownership is huge. It allows people to have to own their homes. So it's actually their home. It's not the band's home. As the old expression goes, nobody's ever washed a rental car. now they own it, so they can put sweat equity into it, and build basically build wealth through their home. Now, when it's just a band home and it belongs to the band collectively, there's a lot less pride as far as this is my house. It's almost like a rental, I guess. So to me that's a huge issue, and I think one of the long term solutions to the housing crisis. I know there's short term things that have to be done, but in the long term, I think that's one of the best goals. Hernando de Soto, who's a scholar from South America and who will be working with the Masters of Development program here at the University of Winnipeg, my understanding, he's written a lot about why does capitalism work in some countries and why doesn't it work in other countries. And one of the things he talks about in his books is this ownership, home ownership, and the benefits of home ownership for all peoples. Not just, I mean, we think about home ownership as being a very kind of affluent goal, but he talks about it really in terms of this should be accessible to everybody.
I want to come back to the issue of interventions and how it affects First Nations. I know some First Nations here in Manitoba are under some degree of co-management or intervention. What usually happens to a band's programs once they go under federal intervention? Start with like the most extreme, the third party management.
Essentially, and no one I've ever talked to likes third party management. I'm an educator by background, and the education directors I've talked to that have gone under third party management, essentially you have zero control of your community spending. So outside accountants come in and they will say, you know, in your school, you've got two librarians, hallway monitor, and two receptionists. You're down to one. You have to find ways to deal with that. So the school administrators in an education setting, they lose complete control over spending in their school. So it's a very intrusive step, I guess. It's not something anybody that I've ever talked to appreciates. Yeah.
And these kinds of arrangements can go on for years. I read about bands that have been under some form of co-management for, you know, more than 10 years.
Yeah.
Is this helping the problem if we're having these bands under this kind of rigorous control for so long?
I guess capacity is a huge issue too, right? You've got one thing that's really needed in First Nations communities are administrators, finance, people trained in finance, all of that. So if that capacity is not in the community, there has to be a way to build that capacity in the community. So there has to be a way to develop that and foster that in the community instead of relying on outside people all the time to come in and do that. If that capacity is not being developed in the community, then it'll stay in that, again, back to that Indian Act relationship. But if that capacity is being developed, and it's one of the reasons why the First Nations leadership really pushed for, when they signed the treaties, they really pushed for education. Because they knew they wanted their descendants to have mainstream opportunities. So they wanted their kids and their grandkids to be able to go to school and go where they wanted to go, work where they wanted to work. At the same time, they wanted them to maintain their cultural identity and their language. So if you don't have that capacity being built up and that education, strong education system happening in the community, it's really easy to get back into that relationship based on the Indian Act, which is very much government on the top, First Nation on the bottom. It's very much dependency built into that relationship through the Indian Act. So it's
and isn't that exactly the kind of relationship that's embodied by these kind of third party management arrangements?
Yeah, so I'd say that's a perfect example of that relationship.
So how can that capacity build if the government can just step in at any point when they don't like what's going on?
Good question. Again, you've got to look at both perspectives too, eh? You've got to look at the government perspective, where they may say, I'm not speaking in any community in particular, but just generally they may say, okay, money is being misspent in this area, or money is not going to education that's supposed to be going to education, or the community is just in huge debt and deficit, and we have to step in and try and sort that out. So that's the government still does have a legal responsibility, fiduciary responsibility for the community and for the kids in the community. So their argument would be that they do have to step in certain extreme cases, which they would call third-party management, and manage the finances. Now, again, the First Nations perspective would be very different, that, you know, you're really infringing on our self-reliance, self-determination, and all that by doing this. So it's a really difficult relationship that can be caused by third-party management. And to me, it goes back to why we really need to strengthen the relationship generally. So between First Nations and all other Canadians. So it's not just boiled down to kind of bureaucratic and political discourse through media and stuff like that. But to me, that the relationship between First Nations and other Canadians should be like a really strong, healthy relationship where both people realize we have obligations, both people realize we have benefits to this relationship, and we're working together to help each other.
I wanted to just kind of briefly touch on the federal, the Financial Transparency on First Nations Act, and what you think that, how you think that will affect this relationship between the federal government and First Nations, or between the Canadian people in general and First Nations people. Do you see this as a positive step forward for that relationship?
Well, I don't want to take a position on that act itself, but I'll give you an example. When I go and talk to I talk to a lot of university classes. So just last couple months ago, I was talking to students here at University of Winnipeg. And the first thing I do is I'll ask them to write two questions on anything Aboriginal related. No holds barred. Don't put your names on it. University is supposed to be a safe place where you can learn. So I'll get them to write two questions. And this is all over the place. So I've been doing this now. And I would say a good half of the questions I get have to do with corruption. So why are chiefs, people will just make statements. A lot of them aren't even questions. It's what, you know, chiefs are corrupt. Why is this happening? Or chiefs are getting paid this much. Why is this happening? Luckily, that last time I was here, I was with an elder from Western Manitoba who used to be the chief of his community. He was the education director. Then he was the chief of his community. When he was education director, he was making $64,000 a year. He became elected chief. His pay went down to $34,000 a year. And he stayed on as chief for four terms, which is 8 years. There's lots of cases of First Nations leadership that are being paid below what their kind of mainstream counterparts would get. And the job of a chief, you got to remember, is basically their mayor and premier. And in some cases, they've got federal level responsibility. So they're everything from policing, education, housing, healthcare. They've got a huge amount of authority in the community and a huge responsibility in the community. So to me, it's a good thing that people know that there's the majority of chiefs are getting what their pay is, and the amount of work they put into the job and the dedication to their communities like that. Because it's in a lot of ways a thankless job. It's a hugely stressful job. They're pretty much on the job 24/7, 365 days a year. So that's good. How you get there, I don't want to get into what I would support or wouldn't support, but I think it's good that people know. There's a lot of chiefs, again, a lot of communities that publish all of their financial statements, their pay scales, in their annual reports as well.
So in general, transparency is good for the relationship between people and their governments?
And their elected leaders, always, yeah, yeah.
All right, well, I think we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
James, thank you so much for coming in and talking with
us. Yeah.
Hopefully this has illuminated some of the issues surrounding these questions and the issue of Aboriginal housing and Aboriginal treaties is very complicated, and we can only hope to, through dialogue, get a little bit closer to the truth.
All right. So it was a pleasure. Thanks.